Okay. Before we go on here, I just want to put the idea in people's minds of the idea of a feeble-minded criminal who somehow managed to yet pull off incredible crimes for which an entire group of people are branded. And I'm going to let Dave read a little bit more, and then we'll talk about some similarities to another feeble-minded criminal that managed to turn up to the Nazis' aid and comfort a little later on.
Now, continuing with the Pink Triangle. Journalists were admonished to play everything down. The Hanover officials wanted no panic. Reporters were also encouraged not to investigate the role of the police. I'm going to repeat that last sentence again. Reporters were also encouraged not to investigate the role of the police. It was on this point that the communists unleashed an avalanche of criticism against the hated Social Democrats. The post of police commissioner of Hanover was held by Gustav Noske, G-U-S-T-A-V-N-O-S-K-E, who, years before, had beaten back left-wing demonstrators by using Reichswehr and Freikorps troops, or Free Corps troops. Originally, Gustav Noske was a social democrat, but he had acted with a vengeance that the radical labor rebels never forgave. He was hated as much as his superior, Karl Severing, S-E-V-E-R-I-N-G, the Prussian minister of the interior and also a social democrat. Altogether, Severing and Noske had put behind bars about 7,000 workers. When the local communist paper, the Niederösterreichische Arbeitszeitung, began to reveal the net of police connections Harman had established as a stool pigeon, its circulation jumped from 8,000 to 35,000. As soon as Noske returned from a vacation, he had the newspaper declared injurious to public safety and banned it. I'm going to read those last two sentences again. When the local communist paper, the Niederösterreichische Arbeiterzeitung began to reveal the net of police connections Harman had established as a stool pigeon, its circulation jumped from 8,000 to 35,000. As soon as Noske returned from a vacation, he had the newspaper declared injurious to public safety and banned it. Rather curious behavior there under the circumstances. Okay, now, again, we're affecting a few engineering difficulties so that we don't have our ID on the tape. Basically, the main points in this particular passage are several. There's several very important points. First of all, as Nip pointed out, the unlikelihood of a feeble-minded individual being able to pull off 127 murders of this type, even in an area which is undergoing the social chaos that Germany was in this historical period. Remember, 1924, which is when this is going on, 3 years after the founding of the Nazi Party, roughly, this was at the height, or the depth, perhaps, of the German inflation. Germany was completely ravaged economically. Still, it appears extremely unlikely that a true feeble-minded person would have been able to pull this off. It is more than a little enlightening that this person was not only a police informer, but apparently ran a network of other police informers, had his own phony detective agency, carried a police badge, and more revealing still is the official reaction when the communist paper began to highlight this. They shut the paper down, they encouraged reporters to not to look into the role of the police, and still more significantly, perhaps, the police commissioner of Hanover at this time was a fellow named Gustav Noske. Now, Gustav Noske is a very, very important figure from the history of this period. Now, let's review just a little bit of the history of Weimar Germany so that what we're about to read here makes more sense. At the end of the First World War, due to a lot of things, the terrible economic conditions imposed by a rigorous British naval blockade, the devastation of the war in the trenches to the population, and plus continuing political turmoil within Germany from the pre-war years, had created basically an untenable situation for the German people. When militarily, particularly because of the entry of the United States, the war became untenable for the high command, and when it was learned that in fact Erich von Ludendorff, the chief of the German general staff, was suing for peace, a revolution broke out in Germany. There were a series of left-wing uprisings for about a two-year period in Germany. Well, actually more than that, but a series of serious left-wing uprisings in Germany for a period of roughly a year and a half to 2 years, beginning roughly in November of 1918 and proceeding until late 1919. Now, in order to put down these abortive communist uprisings, the Social Democrats, who themselves were a relatively liberal group, but who relied heavily on middle-class support, joined forces with the German military high command, and not only was the regular Reichswehr used to suppress these uprisings, but in particular, a series of volunteer military organizations were put together, and it was chiefly these volunteer military organizations, most importantly, the Free Corps, or Freikorps, that put down the abortive German uprisings. Later, as we looked at in a couple of our programs, Radio Free America number 10, also an old Hard Rain broadcast, which is still on file with archives on audio, we took a look at the Freikorps and the so-called Black Reichswehr, which resulted when the Freikorps, the Einwohnerwehren, the Civil Guards, and the Zeitfreiwilligenverbande, the all-volunteer civil guards, were basically these organizations, although officially established by the Weimar government, remained in power even after they were officially disbanded. They functioned as an underground extension of the German military, and they were bitterly opposed to the Weimar Republic. They systematically assassinated not only the communists and leftists, but also all political opponents that could have stopped Adolf Hitler. Hitler's rise to power was essentially paved by the so-called Black Reichswehr, the Freikorps assassinations, okay? Now, interestingly enough, it was Gustav Noske who was in charge of the National Security Establishment in Weimar, Germany, and it was Gustav Noske, more than any other individual, who put together the Freikorps, the Einwohnerwehren, and the Zeitfreiwilligenverbande, which wound up exterminating democracy in Germany. We're going to talk about Gustav Noske. This comes from a book called Paramilitary Politics in Weimar, Germany. It's by James M. Diehl, last name D-I-E-H-L. It's published by the Indiana University Press, and copyright, I believe, 1977. Let me find the title page. Yeah, copyright 1977, Indiana University Press, Bloomington and London, it says here. Now, of Gustav Noske and his role in forming the German volunteer military organizations, which wound up subverting democracy in Weimar, Germany, although they were pledged to defend it and formed initially to defend it, G. Diehl writes as follows. The decision of the Supreme Command during the final weeks of 1918 to cooperate with the government in the creation of a volunteer force was born of necessity, but the situation offered certain advantages. Since the new forces would be hired and paid for by the government, but directed by the Supreme Command, the latter would shape and control the new military force while at the same time avoiding direct responsibility. Adroitly capitalizing on the Social Democratic leader's fear of the left, the OHL, that's German Military High Command, got what it wanted. Government support for the creation of a volunteer force, plus a free hand in forming it. The withdrawal of the independent members of the Council of People's Representatives in late December, and the appointment of Gustav Noske as minister in charge of military affairs, greatly facilitated the growth of the volunteer system. Noske, a right-wing social democrat, shared Ebert's fear of the left and, like him, believed the best way to build a new military force was in cooperation with the old military authorities. With Noske's cooperation and support, the OHL's efforts to replace the rapidly disintegrating conscript army with a volunteer force soon bore fruit. It was these forces, recruited and led by former officers, that were to restore order in the Reich during the first half of 1919. The volunteer forces, which consisted of three types, Free Corps or Freikorps, Auxiliary Volunteer Units, Zeitfreiwilligenverbande, and Civil Guards, Einwohnerwehren, effectively restored order but soon evolved into independent power factors outside the control of the government. By creating, or better, by supporting the creation of a system of volunteer forces and then failing to control it, the new government lost, or failed to achieve, an effective monopoly of armed force and sowed the seeds for the latter paramilitary activity that was to plague the Republic. Although the nature and type of activity of the three volunteer organizations differed, they shared one characteristic. All turned against the Republic. Less direct, but potentially of even greater danger to the Republic, was the manner in which they militarized the police mentality of those predominantly middle-class Germans who flocked to their colors.
Continuing with paramilitary politics in Weimar, Germany. Since the Reichswehr was still in its infancy, the Free Corps, or Freikorps, were probably the single most important power in Germany. Technically, the achievements of Noske and the Supreme Command had been extraordinary. From the shattered and dispirited remains of the defeated German Imperial Army, they had in the space of a few months forged an effective fighting force, which had restored order out of chaos and successfully defended the Ebert government from its enemies on the left. These technical achievements were accompanied by a legacy of brutality and bitterness, however, and were to have serious political and social consequences. Now, this is Gustav Noske. This is the man who started as the essentially the chief of police in Hanover, the legal authority in Hanover, where Fritz Haarmann had his reign of terror. Noske obviously got on the career fast track because he, as we've just detailed for you, wound up being in charge of the military forces of Weimar Germany when the various Free Corps and other, I guess what you'd have to call not only the street fighters, the death squads, were first put together.
Precisely, and the parallel with the death squads in Latin America formed by our own national security establishment, also the ones apparently working in the United States, is more than a little instructive here.
Indeed, and also just, again, to remain topical, the ones that are just even now as we speak being formed in the Philippines due to another executive fiat.
Before we go on to the social effects of the Haarmann case, and again, the key role of Gustav Noske in forming the Freikorps, which paved Hitler's rise to power, his role as police commissioner of Hanover, and the police were quite apparently running Fritz Haarmann, the man who killed 127 people, bears some unnerving similarities to what we've been looking at in a number of other shows for quite some time now. In a program we have on file with archives on audio called The Ultimate Evil, we looked at, among other things, connections of the Manson family with their horrible killings in Southern California and the Son of Sam killings in New York, done by David Berkowitz, not only to explicit neo-Nazi organizations, but also to some satanic cults as well. And we've speculated at length about satanic cults as, at least in some cases, fronts for national security activity. Again, our tape called The Ultimate Evil. We'll talk about that. Mae Brussel, whose work we rely on heavily on this program, in many ways did some pioneering research with her study of organizations like the Manson family, the Siamese Liberation Army, what she referred to as the California violences. Many of the horrible serial killers, the brutal, seemingly senseless murders which afflicted California under the governorship of Ronald Reagan. Recall, California really was not beset with these kinds of killings on a regular basis before then. There have been killers, including some serial killers, in all societies throughout time, but the sudden explosion of Manson family, zebra killer, Zodiac killer type activity was particularly characteristic of the Reagan administration. We've speculated, based on May's research, that in essence the Reagan administration in California could be looked at in a manner similar to the Spanish Civil War, in which many of the tactics which were later to prove so successful in Europe were in fact tried out on a small scale during the Spanish Civil War. We've speculated, and May has speculated, has gone on for many years, about the California violences as, in essence, a form of terrorism which later has proved very applicable to the society as a whole. Recall not only the hard links of the Manson family and to Nazism, but also the political connections. We talked about that in Radio Free America number 12, as well as The Ultimate Evil. But also, in attempting to get a grasp on this kind of information, and by the way, I think I feel safe in speaking for NIF that we understand that new listeners to this program are going to have a real hard time with this kind of stuff. But again, we encourage people to reading. The reason I'm citing these references is not to prove how clever I am, but to enable people who want to pursue this to get the documentation, okay? But just look within yourselves and how people react to these kinds of things. It's not only scary and depressing, but it produces a basically conservative political trend in society. People just get this view that, hey, there are these nuts running around, these screwballs, you know, these angry whatevers, you know, be it, you know, hippies, blacks, or whatever, who are just ready to carve you into shish kebab. They get the feeling in particular that their children aren't safe, that something has to be done. We need law and order. We need strong police. We need a lot of jails. We need more rigorous courts. It really, even though it may not apparently have an ostensible political meaning, it is a very, very political phenomenon, and it benefits the political right. And we're looking not only at the Haarmann case, but also by historical analogy, the California violences and many of the other things we've seen, these serial killings, which seem to be bedeviling the United States, I use the term advisedly, as basically analogs and as political provocations meant to foment political reaction in society.
Now, to go from the macro to the micro, first still at the macro level, or at least talking about the wider picture here in the United States today, those who think these things don't have an effect might think of the various various serial killings that have gotten such play in the California newspapers over the last few years, the Archie Fain, the Hillside Strangler cases, the people of this ilk.
The guy who chopped off that gal's arms, and now and there was a huge hubbub.
I've forgotten his name, but I know exactly who you're speaking about. The one who was let out of prison, and they couldn't find a place to keep him, and now his name has slipped my mind. But we might all notice, of course, what happened to the quote liberal unquote Supreme Court in the state of California, as has happened in another way with the once liberal national Supreme Court. It is no longer, in fact, a liberal Supreme Court. It is, in fact, a stacked conservative Supreme Court, both at the state and the national level. Now, back to the time that we're talking about. If we had only the evidence of the fact that this man, Fritz Haarmann, was, although supposedly feeble-minded, at the same time was working for the police, running a string of informers, had a phony detective agency.
The police under Gustav Noske.
Yeah, the police under Gustav Noske, and pulled off something in the neighborhood of 120 to 150 murders. The real skeptics out there might be able to still be skeptical.
And not just murder, but he chopped people up and sold them as meat.
Yes, an enterprising, feeble-minded guy. Now, however, when we put this into the context of, the Nazis never wanted to miss a trick, and in a way it's sort of ironic that the communists used the Haarmann case to tar the police with the epithet of homosexual in their own bid for power, because then later the communists themselves got sucked into the same trap. A man by the name of Martinus van der Lubbe supposedly burned down the Reichswehr. Martinus van der Lubbe was
Reichstag.
Thank you. Excuse me. Supposedly burned down the Reichstag. Van der Lubbe was supposed to be a communist. He was also another feeble-minded person who, it's very hard to believe that this man could have done this work, but the Nazis managed to string a large amount of their political victories onto this event, the burning of the Reichstag, by a, quote, feeble-minded communist.
Right. In fact, now, bear in mind, the Reichstag was the German parliament building. Hitler had been appointed chancellor by Hindenburg, and then he assumed office, I believe it was January 20th, 1933, and it was February 27th, 1933. Just coincidentally, the German parliament burns down. They blamed it on Martinus van der Lubbe, who was on the scene. Now, he was not only legally insane, he was also legally blind, which is interesting. Also interesting, Hermann Göring had a house immediately right beside the Reichstag, which just so happened to have a tunnel which joined it with the Reichstag building. He and the other top Nazi leadership appear on the steps of the burning Reichstag, blamed it on the communists, had a forceful march, and then used that as an excuse to suspend democratic leadership, democratic political process in Germany, declare themselves dictators to protect the republic from the communist menace. And then, interestingly enough, right at that time was when the formal crackdown on homosexuals in Germany came, along with a crackdown on everybody else.
Now, not to draw the net too wide, but I was just watching a broadcast on TV the other night called Television, which some of you may have seen, which was basically a lot of sound and fury signifying nothing. But again, we saw the rather poignant scene of one Lee Harvey Oswald being brought out of police headquarters in Dallas, and reporters saying, you know, did you shoot the president? And Lee Harvey Oswald, the supposed megalomaniac assassin, saying, I didn't shoot anybody. And a moment later being shot himself, of course, and not being around to make those kind of protestations any longer. One thinks of Martinus van der Lubbe sitting around in a Nazi court, wondering how the heck did I get here, and what the heck am I being accused of?
We're going to go back to the Pink Triangle in a second, but one point that should be made, I think, also since Nitt brought that up, is that in Weimar Germany, as we looked at in a broadcast that's also on file with archives on audio called They Thought They Were Free, there were many people who tried to warn about the Freikorps killings, tried to warn about the coming of Hitler, what his policies would mean. Most people did not buy it, and in fact, today, people who engage in the kind of work that Nip and myself and May Brussel are in are referred to either as conspiracy theorists or paranoid. And the terms in Weimar Germany, they didn't have the psychobabble hadn't reached the same state. They were called alarmists, not paranoid, and they were called conspiracy mongers, not conspiracy theorists, but yet another disgusting parallel.
All right. Now, again, so when we think about things like the Reichstag fire and other things, and we think about the rise of Gustav Noske, and then we look at the Fritz Haarmann case, and in the light of the, as we're going to see especially later on, in light of the eugenics theories of the Nazis, some of the utility of the Haarmann case to the Nazis pushing for power become apparent. We're going to read a little bit more from the Pink Triangle, and then I think we're going to take a break. Anyway, talking about right after and during the time of the Fritz Haarmann trial, the pitch of public hysteria mounted. Many mothers now panicked when their children did not return on time from school, which was all the more understandable because the police had begun arresting child murderers in other cities as well. In Berlin high schools, a grim ditty made the rounds. "Wait with patience, little mouse. Fritz will soon come to your house. With his axe so sharp and neat, he'll make you into red chopped meat." Hirschfeld's appearance as an expert during the Haarmann trial seems only to have deepened the public's animosity toward his committee. It infuriated the Nazis. That the main vehicles for sexual reform, the Scientific Humanitarian Committee and the Institute for Sexual Research, were founded by Magnus Hirschfeld, a social democrat, a Jew, and a homosexual, and that Kurt Hiller, his administrative successor, and many other members were Jewish and liberal, made it easy for Hitler's early followers to vilify all efforts to abolish paragraph 175. As early as 1920, Joseph Goebbels' weekly Der Angriff had expressed its malevolence after Hirschfeld was beaten following a lecture in Munich. The newspaper praised the students for the, quote, sound thrashing administered to Hirschfeld. 7 years later, Wilhelm Frick, a lawyer, later famous for drafting the anti-Jewish Nuremberg laws in 1935, denounced the Social Democrats on the floor of the Reichstag. Quote, "Your party, at its last convention, has demanded the repeal of all laws concerning adultery and homosexuality, and you seem to believe that this will contribute to a moral regeneration of the German nation. We National Socialists are convinced, on the contrary, that men practicing unnatural lechery between men must be persecuted with utmost severity. Such vices will lead to the disintegration of the German people." When in 1929 the Social Democrats and the Communists had succeeded in getting a crucial parliamentary committee to vote in favor of bringing before the Reichstag a bill to strike down paragraph 175, Hitler's official newspaper wrote, quote, "We congratulate you, Mr. Hirschfeld, on the victory in committee, but don't think that we Germans will allow these laws to stand for a single day after we have come to power. Among the many evil instincts that characterize the Jewish race, one that is especially pernicious has to do with sexual relationships. The Jews are forever trying to propagandize sexual relations between siblings, men and animals, and men and men. We National Socialists will soon unmask and condemn them by law. These efforts are nothing but vulgar, perverted crimes, and we will punish them by banishment or hanging." Well, as we all know, banishment would have been lucky compared to what was done. We're going to talk more about that in a moment. I think one other thing that should be mentioned in light of these things that we've been talking about and the effect on the body politic, sometimes in very subtle ways, of these kinds of activities. One of the big things that's gotten a lot of press lately, through no small amount due to the help of the fundamentalist Christian movement, is the issue of not only of child molestation, but of child kidnapping in general. And I remember reading an article the other day where somebody was talking about the fact that there were figures being tossed around of 15,000, 20,000 children being kidnapped every year. These horrifying statistics. And, you know, of course, all the milk bottles and the Donahue shows and the milk carton pictures and the Donahue shows and the Oprah Winfrey shows and everybody talking about that. And it was actually an FBI agent, one of those treasures, an honest and sensible FBI agent. And he was saying, look, let's put it this way. You know, how many people do you know who've ever had a child kidnapped? He said 98% of all the child kidnappings are one parent, you know, a divorced parent, snatching the kid. It goes down as a kidnapping, but everybody knows who's got the kid. You may not be able to find them immediately, but they're not molesters. They're parents. He said in reality there was something like, and I can't remember the exact figure, so I'm making it up here, but this is approximate. There was something like 25 to 75, somewhere in that number of unsolved kidnappings of children per year. Now, admittedly, no unsolved kidnapping of a child is a good thing, and many terrible things do happen to children. But when you consider that the average person in this country who doesn't bother to read the newspapers carefully hears things like 15,000, 20,000 children kidnapped, hears murder, torture, mutilation, satanic ritual stories thrown about left and right, It's no wonder that that we begin to see this kind of hysteria. And then when you link it to the AIDS hysteria, we have a genuine, frighteningly reactionary movement taking place.
Beyond that, in our discussion of the Temple of Set, which may very well be an intelligence front of sorts, the fact of the matter is that they do molest children. They do kidnap children. The numbers I'm not even going to begin to dispute because I myself am not in a position to comment. But I do, one of the things that we've spoken about in connection with these satanic cults, one of the many strategic considerations is that it does, in fact, provide excellent, excellent grist for the mills of those reactionary Christians who want to exploit this sort of thing to try and drive people into their own ranks. And again, I think in addition to the blackmail and the other considerations we've talked about, desensitization to violence, that's something to think about. But again, the thing before, because we're going to break here in a second, keep in mind the Harmon case, the extent to which it panicked people, the extent to which it tarred the gay rights movement with this horrible, bloody stigma, and the extent to which it was used by the Nazis, to stigmatize their political opponents. Magnus Hirschfeld, the commie, Jew, homosexual pervert. You know, that again, that's the central point here. And of course, with that champion of human rights, Gustav Noske, as the police commissioner, it shouldn't prove all that surprising that Hanover would be the site of this particular apparent provocation.
That's right. And one last thing, a lesson that we've all learned and talked about a great deal, is the whole fact of psychological warfare is it doesn't have to make sense. Once the linkage has been established, the reaction is there. It doesn't have to be logical. All you have to do is put pictures of political enemies on the front page next to pictures of headless corpses or under headlines that may have nothing to do with the story, but suggest horrible things, mass murders, etc. All you have to do is make those kind of linkages in people's minds, and after a while, the logic is totally unimportant. The damage has been done, and this is the lesson to learn.
Yeah, again, perhaps not coincidentally, we took a look at Michael Aquino and his background in psychological warfare. That is his specialty as a lieutenant colonel. And again, we speculated about the possibility of the Temple of Set as an intelligence front and perhaps also connected with the Process Umbrella Cult.
We're going to take a break for a few minutes, and when we come back, we will be continuing with this archive like One Step Beyond, talking about the rise and the short thriving and the eventual terrible destruction of the gay rights movement in Germany, and of course making connections to our own age as well, which is what we do best. And we will be the equivalent of like a Radio Free America broadcast, the special focus tonight being the gay liberation movement. Of course, gay was not a word, I don't think, that was used in Germany at that time, although it is a surprisingly it's a word of surprising longevity in terms of how long it's been used to describe homosexuality, not as recent as one might think. But anyway, talking about the homosexual political movement in Germany and how on one hand it itself was tragically snuffed out by the advent of Nazism, but for our purposes, of course, significantly how it was also used by the Nazis as yet another thing to hang around the necks of their those who would oppose them. Not only were you a Jew and a communist, you could be a Jew and a communist and a homosexual, and it was used to great advantage by the Nazis. And we've just been talking about the Fritz Haarmann case, Fritz Haarmann being the homosexual, supposedly feeble-minded murderer who also seemed to be able to run a very impressive operation on behalf of the police department, had a police badge and a phony detective agency, and murdered upwards of 100 people and carved them up into meat and sold them as horse meat. And this case itself rebounded to the against the homosexual political movement in Germany in general, and was used again as fodder for the Nazis in their crusade against virtually anybody who disagreed with them.
And again, the homosexuality was identified also very cleverly by the Nazis with being Jewish, with being socialist or communist, with, in other words, any form of political activity and expression to the left and center was successfully tarred as perverted, criminal, and so forth by the Nazis in considerable measure because of the Fritz Haarmann case, not only an apparent provocation, but one of the great overlooked elements in the development of the Third Reich. Now, we're going to continue with a book which is the mainstay of our broadcast this evening, a book called The Pink Triangle by Richard Plant. More about the Nazis and their attitudes towards homosexuals. Perhaps the Nazi Party's most explicit statement on homosexuality is the one it published on May 14th, 1928, in response to a query about its stance toward reform of paragraph 175. It is worth quoting in full. "It is not necessary that you and I live, but it is necessary that the German people live. And it can only live if it can fight, for life means fighting. And it can only fight if it maintains its masculinity. It can only maintain its masculinity if it exercises discipline, especially in matters of love. Free love and deviance are undisciplined. Therefore, we reject you as we reject anything that hurts our nation. Anyone who thinks of homosexual love is our enemy. We reject anything which emasculates our people and makes it a plaything for our enemies, for we know that life is a fight, and it is madness to think that men will ever embrace fraternally. Natural history teaches us the opposite. Might makes right. The strong will always win over the weak. Let us see to it that we can once again become the strong. But this we can only achieve in one way. The German people must once again learn how to exercise discipline. We therefore reject any form of lewdness, especially homosexuality, because it robs us of our last chance to free our people from the bondage which now enslaves it." Despite these attacks, the effort to reform paragraph 175 continued, albeit fitfully, until the end of 1929, when the Nazis gained 107 seats in the Reichstag, making parliamentary reform impossible. On January 30, 1933, Hitler was named Chancellor of Germany. On February 23rd, pornography was banned, along with homosexual rights organizations. I think that last sentence in that timetable also we might repeat, because it also is similar to certain trends in today's society, today's contemporary America, basically. On January 30th, 1933, Hitler was named Chancellor of Germany. On February 23rd, pornography was banned along with homosexual rights organizations. Of course, one of the major foci, not only of the born-again Christians, but the Reagan administration and certain extremist elements in the women's movement, notably those grouped around Standartenfuhrer Andrea Dworkin, are pushing indeed for a ban of pornography. Neither NIP or I particularly endorses pornography, but the Nazi aversion to pornography, their subsequent subversion of free speech should be borne in mind here.
Right. Because I was not a pornographer, I did not say anything when they came for the pornographers, etc., etc., etc.
Yes, indeed. As luck would have it, Hirschfeld was out of the country on a lecture trip. On March 7th, the SS burst into and searched Kurt Hiller's apartment. On March 23rd, he was arrested and packed off to the concentration camp at Oranienburg near Berlin. 9 months later, incredibly, he was released. He made his way first to Prague and then to London. Hitler's arrest and incarceration was the opening salvo in the Nazi campaign to rid Germany of its homosexuals. On May 6th, the full frenzy of hate was unleashed. The target? Hirschfeld's Institute of Sexual Science, condemned by the Nazis as, quote, "the international center of the white slave trade," unquote, and, quote, "an unparalleled breeding ground of dirt and filth." A band of about 100 young fanatics descended upon the Institute, smashing everything they could lay their hands on. They confiscated more than 12,000 books and the precious collection of photographs. 4 days later, in a public ceremony, these were burned. The crowd roared approval, especially after somebody threw in a bust of Hirschfeld. By the summer of 1933, Ernst Röhm's SA goons were raiding gay bars throughout Germany. Many were closed, but others didn't shutter their doors until 1935. That was the year when the campaign against homosexuals shifted into high gear, and the new Nazi laws banning such gathering places and outlawing homosexuals as sexual vagrants, unquote, went into effect. As for Hirschfeld, he died of heart failure on May 14th, 1935, his 67th birthday, and incidentally 7 years to the day after that Nazi encyclical on homosexuality that we read just a couple of minutes ago. So again, Hitler assuming the chancellery on January 30th, not January 20th, February 23rd, pornography is banned. February 27th, the White Reichstag burns. And 4 days before the Reichstag burns, homosexuality formally banned in Germany. All homosexual organizations, I should say. Homosexuality already was.
I would also want to throw in one more thing when we're since the subject of pornography came up, however briefly. I happen to be one of those lucky people who owns a copy of the hearings, the published hearings of the Mies Commission on Pornography. And if you folks out there, if there's anybody out there who wants an active example of how seemingly democratic institutions can be used to institute fascism, there's a real good example. Just read that book. book, read how the approach to pornography was taken, the way that the committee talked to witnesses, the kinds of conclusions that came out of it. Basically, that was a committee that, if it had set out to find that anything, that elephants can fly, whatever it was, they would have come in with a verdict of elephants can fly. It was it's one of the most enlightening examples of evidence by anecdote that I've ever seen. Basically, what they did is they interviewed a lot of people who'd been molested, raped, or otherwise sexually mistreated, and asked them if the people who'd done it had ever used exposed to pornography. And all the ones who did, they then said, there you go, that proves it.
Yeah, one of the things that should be pointed out here, too, again, pornography itself is such a vast term, and I think I feel safe in speaking for Nip that it embraces things which both he and I would sanction, and things which both he and I would find extremely distasteful. The fact of the matter is, there has never been any link whatsoever shown between rape and pornography. And this is the basic thrust, again, when I jokingly referred to Andrea Dworkin as Standartenführer. The fact of the matter is, she's been very active in crusading against pornography in combination with such champions of democracy as Jerry Falwell. And the fact of the matter is, as distasteful as some of it may be, there has never been the slightest scientific connection demonstrated between rape and pornography. On the contrary, in Sweden, which has always had one of the most liberal attitudes towards pornography, they have one of the lowest incidences of rape. And I think, again, at the risk perhaps of seeming to stretch a point in the eyes of some listeners, thinking about the Fritz Haarmann case, or the Fritz Haarmann case, and the way in which it was used by the Nazis as a psychological warfare tool to tar their opponents, whereas there was no direct connection between homosexuals and Fritz Haarmann, who was actually a police informer and apparent provocateur, and the way in which pornography is being connected with rape in the eyes of the law enforcement and perhaps even eventually national security establishments in this country.
Continuing with the pink triangle and the beginning of the end for the homosexual political movement in Germany, among the first to be jailed were the directors of homosexual rights organizations, which had been proscribed just 4 days before the burning of the Reichstag. Hirschfeld's Institute for Sexual Science was a prime target, as were Kurt Hiller, its chairman, Felix Halle, a legal advisor, and Max Hodan, a respected sex reformer whose books on women's rights, sexual minorities, and abortion had annoyed the Nazis for years. Hiller, Hirschfeld's successor and the most prominent member of the Institute, was shipped to Oranienburg, where he was repeatedly tortured. Through sheer luck, he was discharged and later published a vivid account of his experience. The offices of several prominent homosexual organizations were raided during these early winter weeks of 1933. Stormtroopers plundered the premises of Friedrich Radziwiłł, editor of Die Freundschaft, which means friendship, and took his stepson to jail. Communist and social democratic papers were forced to stop printing. The Nazi propagandists never tired of conjuring up the smoldering debris, the smoking woodpiles, the devastated ceilings of the Reichstag, to declare that this fire was only a beginning. The communists, they said, had destroyed the parliament. Now they would unleash a civil war. German citizens could expect the worst. Only the strongest government measures could save the nation. The strongest measures followed soon. On March 24th, the so-called Enabling Law was adopted, subtitled The Law to Remove the Stress from People and State. In reality, it did away with the Constitution, removed all legal restraints, and gave total control to Hitler and his thugs. It signaled the end of the Weimar Republic and the start of totalitarianism, and it remained on the books until 1945. Again, I just wanted to highlight a couple of things real quickly. Again, that's one of the masterpieces of bureaucrat speak, the law to remove the stress from people and state. The other thing, of course, was, as mentioned earlier, and I did want to stress this point again, not to open wounds, but one of the things, one of the many mistakes that the communists made in Germany was to unwittingly aid in the divide and conquer effort. I mentioned that the Fritz Haarmann case, because of the fact that Haarmann was a police officer, or had a police badge and was affiliated with the police, the communists seized on this, rightly so, to point out that this man, this murderer, this crazy person was in fact affiliated with the police. Unfortunately, they also jumped on the homosexual issue and began to portray Harmon as a homosexual sadist thug, and began to suggest that the police were all homosexual sadists, etc., etc. Again, unwittingly perhaps, but what they did in fact then, while again, the public became further polarized as to whether Harmon was, you know, a police thug or a liberal thug. But everybody agreed at that point then that he was a homosexual pervert. And in effect, what the communists did was to help to destroy potential allies, namely the homosexual political movement. And again, we've had a lot of talk lately on this broadcast about the fact that that the quote left or the quote progressive resistance or whatever is extremely fragmented. And I think the Ben Franklin injunction about hanging together or hanging separately is something that should be taken in mind and held very carefully.
Well, having him say, I'm gonna to a certain extent be a hypocrite in that regard, in that I myself have always been very, very critical of the left. In particular, for those who eventually hear this program on tape, the last few weeks has been some lively discussion between myself and some people from the Socialist Labor Party, and I've voiced some very strong criticism of the left. One of the points, one of the central points Richard Plant makes in this book, although it has only it only crops up in our discussion in connection with the Fritz Harmon case, is that basically the left, the so-called progressive forces in Germany, were just as bigoted in this regard as the right. In fact, there's a brutal passage in here where he, Richard Plant, quotes some correspondence from Engels to Marx in which he comes on with a, well, basically as bigoted, as venal, a homophobic diatribe as one could possibly want. And one of Plant's, again, we're not going to read that in this broadcast, perhaps at a future One Step Beyond, one of the talk show that we have on a weekly basis, it might be interesting to bring it up. But one of Richard Plant's central points in this book is that the left was no different than the right in this regard, and as Nip has very cleverly pointed out, they helped do themselves in this very same regard, again, by way of historical precedent. As I've said before, I'll say it again, the left is just as bad as the right, they're just less powerful, and so their faults are not magnified on the same global scale. If they could command billions of dollars in armies, you'd see the same thing. That obviously is my opinion. Returning to The Pink Triangle by Richard Plant, again, we shall jump back in time from my own opining here, and we shall talk about the plight of the homosexuals in Germany. Homosexuals should especially have been on their guard. As early as the fall of 1933, some were sent to Dachau, to Fuhlsbüttel, and Hamburg. Yet most gays hoped they could weather the storm. Many rushed to join the Nazi Party in the belief that they could vanish among the uniformed crowds. Others hoped for the best, and although bars, cafes, and dancing places catering to homosexuals were eliminated, they tried to continue their lives as unobtrusively as possible. Gradually, many realized that their existence was threatened, and they lived in constant fear of discovery. Others joined the armed forces, over which the Gestapo was never to gain complete jurisdiction. But not until Röhm and his confederates were executed did most homosexuals believe that a country like Germany could fall back into barbarism. Now, however, there could be no mistaking the murderous intentions of the Nazis. There could be no doubt any longer that the Nazis were as violently opposed to sexual deviance as they were to such racial deviance as Jews and Gypsies. The Ministry of Justice and the Berlin headquarters of the Gestapo soon released a deluge of regulations and memoranda designed both to regulate the sex lives of German citizens and to widen the categories of crime. On October 24, 1934, for example, Himmler's still modest Gestapo sent a secret circular letter to police headquarters throughout Germany. They were instructed to mail in lists of all somehow homosexually active persons, unquote. If possible, political affiliations of suspects should be noted together with information on police, on previous police records. Especially welcome were names of politically prominent personalities. That last sentence again, because it bears some echoes for today. Especially welcome were names of politically prominent personalities. That also looks ahead to what we're about to begin talking about. From the start, alleged offenses against paragraph 175 were used as a ruse to arrest people whose politics displeased those in power. Charges of homosexual activities were easily concocted. The authorities could always unearth an ex-convict who could be persuaded to swear that Herr X had fondled Herr Y in a bar. One might even say that the Röhm purge belongs in this category. Political assassination dressed up as anti-vice action. The only difference being that Röhm had indeed been a practicing homosexual. That's Ernst Röhm, head of the SA. The last sentence again. One might even say that the Röhm purge belongs in this category. political assassination dressed up as anti-vice action, the only difference being that Rome had indeed been a practicing homosexual.
We're going to hang on for just